You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 511. If your goals don't scare you, they aren't big enough. Anonymous.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Well, guys, today I have a treat for you. We have returning champion, friend of the show, and all around just great guy, Alex Proyas. And for any of you who don't know who Alex Proyas is, he is the mastermind behind the classic films The Crow, Dark City, I, Robot with Will Smith, The Knowing with Nicolas Cage, and many, many more. Now, we had Alex on a while ago, and he's one of the best episodes of the show and very, very popular. And I actually just recently reached out to Alex to see if he wanted to be back on the show because Alex has seen the same problems that I have and many other filmmakers have, is the distribution model, the traditional distribution model is broken for filmmakers, let alone for short filmmakers. And Alex wanted to build something to help filmmakers to get the word out, to help them get attention, to help them generate revenue with their short films and their work in general. And Alex decided to do something about it. So he created and developed a new platform called Vidiverse. Now, Vidiverse is about to launch. It's not launched yet as of this recording, but they are accepting submissions for their new platform. And it is unlike anything I've seen before. And I really wanted to kind of shine a light on what Alex is doing talk a little bit more about it. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Alex Proyas. I'd like to welcome back to the show returning champion, Alex Proyas. How you doing, Alex?
Hey, Alex. Good. How are you doing?
I'm good, my friend. I'm good. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. I was excited to have you back because of the cool stuff that you've been working on. I've been following you on social media and seeing your shorts and seeing all the, you know, the cool stuff that you're doing. And it just tickles my heart to see an artist creating and not waiting for someone to give them permission to create. And you are a champion of that. So first, before we even get started, thank you for being that inspiration to so many people out there.
Well, you're very, very welcome, and ditto to you.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you. So we're going to be talking about your new streaming platform, Vidiverse, which sounds amazing, and I really wanted to promote what you're doing because I know it's coming from a really great place. But before we jump into that, I want to kind of go out a little bit. In your opinion, what are the major issues filmmakers have with getting their work seen and then also getting paid to get that work seen.
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of pretty impossible. And, you know, YouTube seemed for a while to be a kind of a way through, you know, the fact that we could put our content on, we didn't have to ask anyone's permission. It didn't matter what, how good, bad, or indifferent, how mm-hmm. much money we'd spent, how much money we hadn't spent, whether our friends or family were in the cast, you know, it didn't matter. We could get our films out there and get people to see it. But unfortunately, you know, YouTube seems to have kind of developed a stricter and stricter policy about who derives any income from such content, you know. And look, you know, the, you know, there's always a success stories of people who manage to stream their content and get millions of views. But, you know, most people's situations are, and there's some good films out there, I know, because I've been looking, they get very few views. They just don't know how to get their films through the sort of, you know, YouTube algorithm, you know. So it's really hard for those people who, you know, to keep building their films through that platform. And, you know, there's obviously platforms like Vimeo, which are, can be much more specifically targeted, and you can, you know, that your films look better on Vimeo, etc. But, you know, there's really nothing between those sort of two ends of the spectrum where, you know, you can your films can get seen by people, and maybe you can derive what little small amounts of income your film might generate. You know, YouTube seems to soak it all up through advertising. You know, they make their billions, but the filmmakers very rarely see any of that, you know.
I think that's as a general statement. I think that's, I mean, going back to when the United, when United Artists opened up, when Chaplin and Pickford and Flynn got pissed off from the studios not paying them, that they opened up their own studio. I think that is, it's, isn't that kind of the way it works with Hollywood and generally just the big business? I think big business in general, when business and art get together in any art form, the artist always seems to get the short end of the stick, no matter what medium it is. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, always. I mean, you know, the entertainment industry, and not just film, music and everything else, you know, work on the fact that it's, there's endless streams of exploitable young people coming through who want to be exploited. You know, I wanted to be exploited when I was a young pup. You know, I was like, yeah, come on, exploit me, let me do this stuff, pay me some sort of, you know, pittance of money just so that I can do my thing, you know. And that's kind of always been the way, and the industry, you know, the corporations have always kind of, you know, succeeded based on that cannon fodder, I call them, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's still the same to this very day. I mean, you know, Hollywood would rather work with some young pup right now than some schmuck like me who's cynical and who gets how the whole business model works and wants to change it, you know, because it's just easier for them, you know, and they'll make all their money. And so YouTube, you know, is a sort of an offshoot of that. It just works on the same sort of exploitable principles, you know. Yeah, give us your free content, give it to us for nothing, we'll show it, you know, that's what you get out of the equation, and we'll make billions of dollars out of it. I mean, what is it about that business model that works for the filmmakers, you know?
Right. And you know, it's fascinating because even in the 80s, 90s, even the early 2000s, a studio would have never given a young pup $200 million or $150 million to make a tentpole film. But that seems to happen much more now because of what you're saying, like specifically Marvel. And a lot of, they have a machine, basically. And I've talked to people who've worked within the Marvel machine, and they just kind of just, they just, it's it like almost insert director here. Yes, they're guiding the process, and certain directors have more say than others. But generally speaking, they're giving, like, I remember I read an article with Ridley Scott. Ridley Scott's like, I don't even understand how this is, like, why would you give a 25-year-old $100 million and not give Ridley Scott or yourself $100 million to do it? And you're right, is because you guys know how the game is played and they don't want to deal with you.
Yeah. And it's also because, you know, those films, not to spend another session ragging on Marvel, but
I certainly enjoy them as well.
Those movies kind of make themselves, you know, and it's arguable how important the director is. It's kind of like a long-running TV series. Everyone knows what they're doing, you know, and certainly the producers of those movies know what they're doing. They've made many countless successes. So they'll just, you know, it just kind of rolls along and the director comes in and talks to the actors and, you know, hangs out with the actors, I guess, is what the role is, you know. So I'm not my idea of filmmaking, really.
Right.
But, you know, look, good on them. I just feel like, you know, we need to be thinking of other ways forward, you know.
Especially for not only young filmmakers, for artists in general, filmmakers in general, that they need to get not only the work seen but paid for. But I have to ask you, do you have any stories of your misadventures in Hollyweird with falling prey to Hollywood accounting or something? Not, you know, you were like, what? Like, at what point did you? I'm assuming somewhere in your journey, you got a check and you said, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, no, it happens to me on a weekly, monthly basis still to this day.
For movies that you've done?
I received you know, there were these things called residuals, you know, that we used to get, which were actually really great. They kept us alive between movies, you know, because the fact is, as filmmakers, you know, even if you're very successful as a filmmaker, you know, you get your payday once every few years and you get paid, you know, I was paid very handsomely, but then that money is going to stretch out over many, many years and it starts to become less significant, you know. So I was reliant on residuals to keep me alive, as were many filmmakers that I knew, that I know very well. And unfortunately, the residuals, you know, Netflix and the streamers don't pay residuals. So suddenly they've dropped in the last few years to very small amounts of money, to the point where, you know, I got a check for Dark City a few months ago, which was, you know, of note enough to post on my Instagram account for $7.36, you know.
That's insulting.
Which is, you know, that represents a quarter of all the total residuals that I received for Dark City. Now, that's just kind of insulting. I'd rather just not get the check. I'd rather they just held on to it. I keep meaning to call the authorities that deal with the residuals and say, just hang on to them in your bank account. Maybe they can earn a little bit of interest until they amount to something at least over $50 or $100, you know, because quite frankly, it actually costs me more to cash that check.
Because it's U.S.
It's a U.S. dollar.
Yeah.
It costs me $25 to cash it. So I actually lose by doing that, you know.
Oh my! It's like that Seinfeld. So, it's like that old Seinfeld episode where he got, like, you know, 100 or 500 1 cent residual checks. He had to sign all of them.
And yeah.
like, why am I doing
this? Exactly right. So that's where we're at, you know. And you know, cut to a few years ago, and you know, we could survive between movies on what we were getting from residuals every year. You know, it would pan out to enough to keep you, you know, pay your mortgage and feed your family, you know. So that was great. So you could work on your scripts and work on your projects and not be beholden to the, you know, the bank manager, the wolves at the door, you know. So yeah, it's not a good situation. We're being pushed into creative people are being pushed into these more and more untenable scenarios, you know, at the moment. That's been going on for some time.
Yeah, I mean, if I always tell filmmakers, if you want to see what's happening and is going to happen, was just look at the music industry. I mean, music has turned into it has no worth. It's like literally pennies, fractions of pennies.
Yeah, it's all about, you know, data rates, and we basically follow where music goes, film follows. You know, which is exactly what's going on. You know, the music streaming services are doing very well, as are the film streaming services, you know.
And the labels. And the labels.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, as it's always been, you know. And so, of course, you know, we're looking at all this, and it's only been exacerbated, as we said, it's only been exacerbated by the pandemic. It's become more and more extreme. You know, I went from dreaming of owning a theatre one day. Like, I wanted to, you know, I've always wanted to own, like, my own cinema, you know, like a paying, you know, movie house. And I've gone from that to dreaming of owning a streaming service because I've just got to face the writing on the wall. It's like it's just not, you know, we're just not there at the moment. You know, we're not, whether or not we'll get through this this pandemic and another, some God help us, something else will happen and we'll be locked down again. Who the hell knows? Who can predict the future now, you know?
Yeah.
It seems like the only certainty right now is on the internet.
Yeah, and I think that's where everyone's going to eventually. I think hopefully cinemas won't go away like the way of the dodo, but I think it will become much more specific, very much like Broadway is, you know, tickets will be better. We will still want to have those events, but going to see an independent film in a mass way, other than if it's an art house, is not going to happen. It's just too much content to fight.
I agree, and I think that's really the most pertinent point. That you've put so well is it's more, you know, the cinemas will survive, sure, but I think they'll be servicing the Marvels and the streamers. You know, I think there certainly is a demand for that big screen experience that will probably never go away, as a few recent, you know, releases have shown us. But what about everyone else? You know, I think we have to sadly embrace the optimistically and hopefully embrace the internet medium and try and make that our own, at least, you know, as much as possible.
And
I remember hearing about Radiohead, you know, when the music streaming first started hitting hard a few years ago. I remember hearing about Radiohead releasing an album in that way, only available over the internet, and I'm like, gee, that's kind of a weird thing to do. But now, of course, I go, well, that was prophetic. You know, they were really trying to wrestle control back into their camp as individual artists, you know. And I think that seems to be the sort of place where filmmakers are at the moment.
But the thing is that it's because, like you said earlier in the conversation, every filmmaker could put their movie out and on YouTube. It's tomorrow, and anything could go out. But unfortunately, just like the musicians, they have to not only be artists, but they have to be business people, marketers, web designers sometimes. They have to have so many other things other than being just the artist to be able to survive, as just to be able to survive. And if you're not lucky enough to be a Radiohead that built their entire their fan base on the backs, on the dime of the label that got them to be that big, you know, like, and same thing with filmmakers. I mean, I've said this many times, like, you know, a Kevin Smith, a Spike Lee, you know, Martin Scorsese, we know these names because they've been working within the studio system for so long. And that's what got their name up there. But like the indie guy who has one indie and didn't have, like, you know, studios pushing it, it's hard to get that name going unless you build your own thing up, you know, by yourself.
Yeah. Exactly right. That's exactly right. It's you know, and it's arguable, you know, whether through the current system will it get any more of those names coming out of the woodwork. You know, it's very, very. It's becoming increasingly rare, and I feel like that's why it's time for something for a new way forward. You know, the auteur has been kind of watered down over the years. You know, we've been made to, the commercial concerns have tried to diminish the importance of the auteur. You know, I've actually read so many articles about why the auteur theory is wrong, and, you know, I grew up with the auteur theory. Mm-hmm. They're the sort of filmmakers that I followed as a kid, and that's the sort of filmmaker I wanted to become. You know, and, you know, it's been, you know, a pretty difficult road to get to that point through the commercial system. You know, so I think it's very important that we hang on to that original creator kind of approach to things. And it seems to me that the indie world is where those filmmakers appear these days. You know, the ones that are already the mainstream auteurs that are already there have done their dash, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we're going to get that many new ones appearing through that system. And I think the indie world is where they're going to be coming from in the future.
I mean, I think the only way that happens is an indie person gets a shot of a big studio movie. That big studio movie makes a lot of noise, and then they can go back and start doing their own indie stuff. Like, Guillermo del Toro was a good example of that, but that's still, we're still going back 10, 15 years. Yeah. But Tahiki, the guy who did Thor and Thor Ragnarok, Tahiki, I never could pronounce it, New Zealander. Wonderful, wonderful. That's a new name that it kind of popped up. He was an indie guy, got Thor, and then now he's. But even then, we're still talking about handful. We're talking about maybe two, three, four. But the days of the 90s when there was like, you know, Robert Rodriguez, Spike Lee, you know, all these names just started popping up every month. It was insane. Yeah. Those days are gone.
Guillermo's been around as long as I have. I mean, he's not a fresh
puppy. No, he's not. He's not a fresh puppy at all. But he started off in the indie world, but he came up in the 90s. And he didn't really pop until in the 2000s. But he's been around for a long time as well. So it's disheartening for, and I think a lot of creators listening now who didn't grow up in the 80s, 90s, and the early 2000s don't understand what that world was like. You know, to have someone like yourself do The Crow and then do Dark City and to do I, Robot and these kind of films, it's just, you know, I don't know. It's sad. It's just
well,
sad.
Well, I think we may have talked about this on the last podcast we did, but the, you know, in those days, you know, I was like, hey, I'm going to do a film based on an original underground comic book, you know, that no one's heard of. And it's like, yeah, great. Sounds like a great idea. You know, here, have money to make a movie, you know. You know, it was like there was no question about – it wasn't – you know, the industry was still interested in original stuff, you know, with Dark City – in particular, you know, hey, I'm going to make a film based on nothing, based on something that came out of my head, you know, in this weird world that doesn't exist, you know. Yeah, sounds like a great idea. Let's go. Let's do it, you know. I mean, this stuff just doesn't occur now. Not at that sort of budget range, at least, you know. Yeah, right. So it's, it is definitely a new whole new world right now.
And I think the only one really doing it, the only one out there who could be the auteur and also work within the studio system is Christopher Nolan. And he's the only filmmaker I know that has the juice that he's got right now. I mean, I don't know if you saw the details of his deal, but I was like, Jesus, he wants everything. I think this is fantastic. Give that man whatever he wants.
Yeah, that's pretty funny, No, it's like, you know, he's a very rare exception. Yeah. I don't think anyone is in that situation. But look, you know, I mean, you're only as good as your last movie, really.
Correct. You know, no matter who you are.
His Warner's deal was probably even better than the one that's just been publicized. I think he's probably taken a little bit of a step backwards based on the box office of the last film, you know. So, you know, it's
No one's bulletproof.
A rarity.
No one's bulletproof. There was a moment in time where I heard people saying, "Oh, it's over for Spielberg. He's done," because he did a couple of bombs back to back, and then of course he came out with Jurassic Park and Schindler's List in the same year and shut everybody up. He's like, "Oh, really? Let me do this for you guys."
Exactly.
But that's just the way the game is played. That's the way Hollywood is. But I wanted to ask you. You know, we talked about YouTube a little bit. Is there a because obviously there's a lot of people making money on YouTube, and you can make money. A living is another question, but you can't make money on YouTube with a massive amount of content or a very specific niche. But I haven't seen filmmakers make money on YouTube.
I haven't seen short films and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, you know, like what you do is perfect for YouTube and you know, doing commentary, doing reviews, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to be an information-based success story YouTube, you know. And I know from the sort of stuff that I watch on YouTube, I very rarely go, hey, let's check out someone's short films. I'm only doing it now because of what I'm proposing, you know, but it's not the place to go for short films, you know. Having said that, some filmmakers that I know have had, you know, one-off huge successes. Suddenly their short film takes off, you know. Often that's, you know, that's supercharged by, you know, groups like Dust or these sort of ideas that basically promote, you know, genre-based content, you know. Right. You know, but it's not a perfect model, and it's partly because, and nor is Vimeo a great model, because you never know what you're going to get. You know, you never know as a viewer what you're going to get when you buy a subscription to Netflix. You know, it's a little less of a crapshoot. I mean, that's a bit of a crapshoot still. Mm-hmm. But people don't consider it as much because there's so much more available. But, you know, there's a certain quality control that goes into what you're going to be able to tune into. And a lot of it's very heavily promoted and advertised. So you kind of know what you're getting, you know, when you subscribe. You know, YouTube could never be that because it is a completely scattershot kind of approach to content, you know. So, you know, it's always going to be that little thumbnail that grabs your attention. Someone being angry about something usually is what grabs your attention, and off you go, and you're going to watch the first 30 seconds before you realize, you know, you don't want to watch this thing and go to the next thing. You know, that's the YouTube viewing for you, not conducive to watching a story being told, you know. So, you know, look, I think that's really the key, and that's why it doesn't seem to work for people. Other than, you know, some, as we say, some of the success stories, there can be, you know, a guy playing computer games, you know, and it's like, you know, I don't, being, you know, someone who wants to watch a story being told, it's not really my cup of tea, but it's obviously the cup of tea of many, many millions of people, you know.
Now, you know, you've had the privilege of working on indie projects as well as giant studio projects, all feature films. But you tend to keep going back to shorts. I wanted to ask you your opinion on shorts as a medium in general. Do you think it's something that is valuable not only for artists to express themselves, but valuable for filmmakers to either grow their careers or experiment? Or what's your feeling on shorts as a general statement?
I think absolutely everything you've said. I do think they're very valid. I mean, I equate them to being like, you know, as a writer, you write novels and you write short stories. I mean, people don't turn away from the short story form once they've written a novel. It's just as valid a form of, you know, creativity. And I've always liked short films. I like watching them. I've been on many juries to judge short films. I've been to, you know, in festivals all over the world to judge short films and features. But I think they're just as valid an art form. And the only reason they haven't been considered by the mainstream as a valid art form is you can't make any money out of them as a producer or as a studio, you know. So that's really the reason I believe the art form has never really taken off. But as an art form, it's completely valid. As a filmmaker, you learn, you know, there's a real art to telling a succinct story, grabbing someone and grabbing an audience and holding an audience for that short period of time is a huge art form. And it's one that, you know, I discovered making TV commercials and music videos way back when, you know, and one that I continue to explore and experiment with in, you know, narrative short filmmaking, you know. And I encourage everyone to continue doing it. It's actually interesting. I've noticed a few feature filmmakers recently, because I've had a short pop up in a few festivals around the world, and I've noticed there's some other feature filmmakers out there like me who also have been, you know, sending their short films out to festivals to because it's one of the few sort of outlets for short filmmakers, you know. So it's kind of interesting. I think a few other people are probably feeling the way I do about them, about the medium right now, you know.
Yeah, it's always, you know, monetizing shorts has always been the problem. I've been able to do it a couple times, but many times I failed being able to recoup my money or actually make a hefty profit. It's rare to be able to do if you have something that's focused on a niche audience, maybe things like that. But it's tough. It's tough. And I've seen so many people try to figure it out, you know, which brings me to Vidiverse and what you're doing with Vidiverse. First of all, what is Vidiverse, and when did this idea come up to you? When the idea came to you? Was it when you decided, I can't buy a movie theater anymore? That's just ridiculous. I need a streaming service. When did this come up, and what is it?
Oh, look, it's been on my mind for many, many years. And in fact, I actually tried to create a filmmakers website 20 years ago called Mystery Clock, which was, you know, with the view to eventually do what we are now embarking on with Vidiverse. It's taken all that time for the technology to get to the point where you're not watching postage stamp size.
Oh God, you know, it was so bad.
Films.
It was so bad.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But you know, I built a future-proofing my world, my filmmaking world, going, this is where it's going to go eventually. Back then, I had that sort of prophetic vision, and I knew that it would take some time. I just didn't realize how long it would take, you know. So that site sadly failed eventually. But here we are now in 2021, and this stuff is doable. And I think, you know, for me, the idea came from the fact that, you know, we can't, you know, It was a multi-pronged thing. One is Vidiverse wants to eventually be streaming features and everything, you know. But we're starting with shorts because shorts to me seemed the real weak point for independent filmmakers, you know. And as I say, because I've been judging so many short film festivals recently, a lot of isolation type style film festivals because of the pandemic. I mean, I've been blown away by the quality of the work. It's really outstanding, you know. And I just did one a few months ago here called Flickerfest. It's a big deal in Sydney. We managed to sneak in between the lockdowns, and it was a live event. They did it in a sort of open air area near the beach in Sydney, so we could all, you know, occasionally pull our masks down and drink our beers as we were watching the shorts. And it was an awesome. It just reminded me again of not just this power of theatrical presentation, but more so the power of the short film medium. You know, the audience had a great time watching, you know, a two-hour program of short films from all over the world, different genres, different ideas, different narratives. But the one thing they had in common was there was a quality to them all. They were all of really high quality, and it was actually really, really hard. I watched maybe I was judging the international program, and over about a couple of weeks, I think I watched maybe 70 short films, and it was really hard to pick winners because there were so many great ones. You know, we actually ended up creating awards, prizes for specific films that where the prizes didn't exist because we liked the quality of the film so much. You know,
that's awesome.
So I think through that process, I started thinking, you know, It's just criminal that these films are not seen by a wider audience beyond the sort of the you know, the film festival circuit. And I started thinking more and more specifically at that point about creating a streaming service that could program, a bit like the way a film festival works, program a series of short films that were maybe even more had more common threads to them, maybe genre or stylistic threads that could bring a program of 6, 7, 8 short films together. And then whether there was some way to monetize that for the filmmakers and also, of course, for the platform to exist, to create a market for this content, you know, but basically saying, okay, well, we are me, and as I said to you at the beginning of this call, was, you know, at the moment I'm looking at all the films myself because to me the curated aspect of this is really important. That, you know, I initially and hopefully eventually others at Vidiverse can maintain a standard of curated quality, so that then we do have that guarantee to an audience who are coming into it and paying money to watch these films that may or may not be available in other parts of the internet. But we're saying, if you come to us, we guarantee that you're going to get a package of great content, great filmmaking, you know. And that's really the whole sort of, you know, origin of this idea.
You know? So Vidiverse at the moment will you're accepting short films. You're looking at short films. Is there eventually going to be a financial, arrangement for the filmmakers as far as, you know, profit sharing, things like that? Or right now, is it just purely an exhibitional platform?
No, there is a fund we want to have a licensing scenario. And we don't want to exclusively license, because for me, it's all about, I don't want to limit filmmakers' ways of making money. If they're making money from their films in other ways, I don't want to get in the way of that, you know. And some of the films that we're dealing with, they are already on other platforms, you know. So we're not about exclusively licensing, but we are about packaging short film content with other like-minded short film content to kind of supercharge their potential to make money, you know. We'll be cutting trailers that are not just one person's film, but a series of short films that are all part of the program. And that way, as I say, a subscriber or a user of this platform can at least get a, if you like one, you'll probably like the other's kind of approach, and watch a program that's, you know, not just 10 minutes long, but is feature length long, you know, or maybe even longer, of short films. But they're buying into the program as such, and any funds that are generated, because, you know, the reality is this is all highly speculative, whether or not much funds are generated or not.
Of course,
you know, remains to be proven. But all those, whatever funds are generated, will be split between Vidiverse and the filmmakers involved with each package, you know.
So is this
at least that's what we're embarking upon. And then when we get into features, and when we get into, you know, we want to get into, like, if we like specific filmmakers, we want to get into programs of specific filmmakers' work. You know, many of these filmmakers have created more than one short film, so if we like one, we'll probably like more. So we're investigating that with a few filmmakers at the moment to basically monetize their brand and make their brand something in this quest for the auteur, the new auteur, to create a kind of brand identity within Vidiverse for individual specific filmmakers, you know.
Now, is this going to be, is this TVOD, SVOD, AVOD? I want to say that, is it transactional, is it subscription, or is it advertising based?
It's probably going to be a combination of things, and we're developing it, so we're still trying to nut through the logistics, let's say, and, you know, and we're also trying more specifically, but it is a process we're going through right now, and part of the reason we're still kind of, you know, working that stuff out is because we're not certain right now how big a platform we want to launch. You know, this started all from me going, I just want to get my own stuff out there on all my shorts. I want to take it off YouTube and get it onto a platform. Let's just launch that. And I've got this project called Mask of the Evil Apparition, which is doing very well in the festival circuit at the moment. Use that as a way. Let's just try it and see, right? So it went from that, and like all my other mad projects, it starts off at a very crude fundamental level and then evolves into this monster. And so we're in mid transformation into the monster right now, with more and more. And I was saying, I'm a bit fearful about talking to you and you getting the word out, because I'm fearful of how many more short films I'll actually have to watch, you know, and how much less of a weekend I'll have with my family as a result. So we're trying to balance all those factors before we go, yes, it's subscription model, and we don't want people to come and be disappointed by how little content there is. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's a balancing act, you know? So it may launch. I want to, you know, personally, and there are other people involved, other partners involved with this venture who have their word as well. But personally, I want to see this launch as soon as possible. My feeling is to launch it with whatever we have, you know, and make it like a sampler, and maybe give subscribers a kind of early adopter discount if you decide to subscribe with the small amount of content that we have, knowing that it's going to grow into something much bigger. So it will probably end up being something along those lines, you know.
Fair enough. And, you know, this seems, first of all, this has been fantastic. I love the idea of what you're doing. I love that you're doing it and your taste and your curation is doing this, which is what I love, because there's been a lot of other streaming services that pop up. I get contacted by streaming services, new streaming services on a weekly basis. Hey, we got this new streaming service. Hey, we're for the independent filmmaker. And I look at their sites and I'm just like, I can't even, you know, I've been offered, like, could you buy our streaming service? Like, no. like, no, I don't want to buy your streaming service. But when I saw you doing it, I was like, okay, this is something more interesting. It just takes everything up to a different level when you're involved, because I'm such a fan of your taste and of your filmmaking that I think what you're bringing in, I think your lens. Everything's being funneled through your lens, and that's what's exciting. I'm like, okay, he's going out and bringing in this amazing content. I think that's a big selling point for what you're doing. But I'd love to ask, what's the goal 5 years from now, 10 years from now? Do you know how big do you want to get? What do you want this to eventually be for filmmakers?
I hope this can be a real thing. I hope that we can make it a viable industry that people can actually create their content, put it on this website and earn enough from their content that is, you know, that makes it viable for them to keep making content, you know. I mean, we're trying to, across the board with everything we're doing right now, is reevaluate the economic structure of filmmaking, you know. From producing to making from developing to producing to distributing, right? Mm-hmm. And Vidiverse for me is the sort of final prong of that triangle of creation, which allows filmmakers to get their stuff seen by people. Because as we've always said, if it's one thing to make your film with all this wonderful technology that makes it affordable and easy to do, if no one sees it, then it's like the tree falling in the forest, you know. So the distribution part of this is absolutely essential. So I hope this is the final part of that, you know, that can make it a new viable way to make films and to survive and to earn a living making films. You know, now that's a lofty goal, and I certainly think that's a few years off, because I'm not guaranteeing that to any individual filmmaker who's, you know, submitting their work to Vidiverse at the moment. You know, if I manage to get them a check for a few bucks at the end of every quarter, I'll be like, yeah, that's a success story, you know. But I hope we can build on that. I hope as we get more subscribers, more people interested, we can keep building this as an idea, you know.
Now, but will the residual check be bigger than your Dark City residual check is the question.
Well,
you can't guarantee. But the hope is that you can make a little bit more.
Look at it on those terms, right?
Isn't that scary?
when you look at it on those terms, you know, I've just made this film called Mask of the Evil Apparition, which is going to be one of our first launched so-called Vidiverse originals, right? We're going to launch it and say, you can buy this short film by this schmuck Proyas for, you know, $2.99 or whatever, you know, 50 cents or whatever we're going to put on it. We don't know, you know, or subscribe and you get it for free or whatever we're going to say, you know. And honestly, I would be amazed if, you know, there have been so many people reaching out to me from my own followers going, how can we see this film? Yes, we'll pay for it. Yes, let us know and we're there. And that's maybe a few hundred people, and maybe there's more people out there. You know, maybe some of those people are lying. Maybe they won't pay for it when they see the trailer. But it's going to be more than $7.95, you know. I mean, I am going to get a little bit more, I know. So there you go. The model already, I believe,
working.
Will work.
It's already working. The bar is low at $7.95.
That's right.
The bar is fairly low that you've got to break for this to be a success for you.
Yeah.
You should frame that check in the offices of Vidiverse. Like every day, guys, every day. That's what we are. Go break that $7.95.
Yeah.
Now, exactly. When is this, right. When are you releasing this to the world?
Well, that I can't be specific about either. We're hoping before the end of the year or early in the new year.
Okay.
And again, it's about reaching that critical mass where we go, yeah, this is great. And, you know, we're building the site. Again, we have there's no financing behind this. It's all me waking up one day and going, yeah, I'll put some of my own dollars into that idea, that stupid idea. And I've got my Heretic Foundation colleagues who are helping me create this this thing. So it's a somewhat unplanned. It's an unplanned business plan right now. so, you know, that's why it's has to remain a little flexible.
Of course. You're still trying to figure this all out, but I think the intentions are good of what you're trying to do, and the idea is solid, and I can't wait to see what you guys come up with. I really can't. And I'm so.
Can I also? Yeah. I'll just be clear though. The site is open for submissions. You know, mm-hmm. we are actually accepting submissions from anyone and whoever, wherever they are. We're getting submissions from all over the world right now, and language is not an issue for us as long as there's English subtitles on the project. We're getting really cool stuff out of Europe and Mexico and all sorts of great filmmaking centers. And so, you know, we're open for business in that respect, at least to create what that library is going to be before we launch, you know.
That's awesome. I'm excited to see what you come up with. I mean, I'm so happy that, you know, filmmakers like you are still going up to the plate and taking the big swings, where many don't. Many just stick to their own work and their own art, but you're actually trying to help other filmmakers and try to give other filmmakers voices in the next generation a way to keep doing this in the way that, you know, you and I were able to do it when we were, you know, coming up. It's like, you know, a way to sustain ourselves as artists. So I'm so happy that you're still taking those swings, my friend.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, I think we have to. It's a kind of a existential crisis that we're all in, you know, we're all in together in that respect. So I feel like it's got to be done, you know, and, you know, I think what you mentioned earlier on is important, that, you know, you are seeing stuff through my lens. I've always said over the years, people always ask me what I think about other filmmakers' work. And I go, I never want to be a critic or a reviewer of other filmmakers' work, because it doesn't matter what I think about the work. Every film is hard to make. It doesn't matter whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. You know, they should be, encouraged because they've made a film. You know, and it's the same with every level of filmmaking, I believe. You know. And it's kind of, this is kind of my opportunity to encourage films that I really like, you know. It's for me a really specific way of doing it. I'm not criticizing other films. All I'm saying is these films are ones that I think are worth looking at. And, you know, the quality varies, the budgets vary wildly, the resources are going into it, the acting quality, whatever. And it's just stuff that I think is cool, you know. That's really at the end of the day, you know, what comes through all this stuff. And I hope that we can carry that through as we move forward. You know, stuff that's cool. You know, that to me is the only, you know. And something that holds you, that engages you, that makes you want to watch. Maybe it's because it's doing something you've never seen before, something that's weird, that's interesting, that's unusual, or just it could be a very small, you know, real world story that's being told in, you know, without any genre kind of influence or whatever. I mean, it really doesn't matter. It's all about just something that is, as I say, cool, you know.
The cool factor.
Yeah,
exactly. Now, I really love you to talk a little bit about what you're doing at the Heretic Foundation and your virtual production studio that you're building in Australia and everything, because I'm a huge fan of the technology, but you really kind of spearheaded this technology. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we built this studio, it's close to a year and a half, 2 years ago now. which was it's a virtual production facility. Basically, it's a way to create. Well, it's actually a bigger idea than that. It's a way to bring all the aspects of filmmaking under the one umbrella. You know, mm-hmm. I say ironically now because we've actually just moved into our own VFX facility, which is a kind of a sister company to Heretic. It's still Heretic Foundation, but it's mm-hmm. like where all the VFX get done, you know, because we're growing, you know. But it's a way to use virtual production to streamline how films are made, to still be able to bring enormous, great production value, but at a lower budget range, you know, when you don't have to move around, when you don't have to go to multiple locations, when you don't have to build big sets, et cetera, you can work faster and more expediently. You can bring the cost of the production down, or more importantly, you can elevate the production value of lower budget indie films, which is kind of the real key for me. You know, now that we've just completed, or we're completing our first feature, not my film, one for another director, a guy called John Curran. It's a film called Mercy Road, which is it's a road movie at night. It's set in real time, a guy in a truck. It's a thriller. It's a bit like Duel, but mm-hmm. it's kind of more gothic and sort of dark and spooky, you know. And we've created the entire world for this film. We've made the all this, you know, he's in the truck a lot of the time, but he gets out and he goes to various different locations. The whole world is basically being created by Heretic in virtual space, and we've shot it with a combination of LED screens and green screen in numerous situations as well, and it's looking fantastic. It's really quite wonderful what the material that I'm seeing at the moment. So that to me is a great example of elevating a fairly low budget thriller, indie thriller, to a level where the visuals are ones you would associate with a very expensive, you know, studio movie, you know. That to me is an exciting success story already of Heretic Foundation, and one we hope to keep building on. We have numerous other projects lining up. That one is a World War II film set on a battleship, which again, you know, they wouldn't even consider doing it on the budget that they have. And in fact, they've tried to raise a larger budget and been unable to. And it's the technology that we're able to bring to it that's making the film actually achievable, you know. And that's a really exciting world to be in, you know.
Now, when you say and for a lot of people listening, virtual production. You know, when I think of virtual production, I think of The Mandalorian and the volume and stuff. Have you created similar volumes and using green screen? So you have a volume, and then you also do some elements in green screen as well. So it's a hybrid, if you will.
Correct. That's right. Yeah, we Heretic. We're currently building a LED volume, a large LED volume, in cooperation with another company. And we've been doing mainly green screen. Our studio has green screen. I mean, it's quite a small stage. I mean, our studio is really designed as an R&D stage, but we're building. We've just done this one film in another volume, but we're building a dedicated LED volume. It will be LED and green screen because it's the combination of the two that works so well. You know, there are some things that a la Mandalorian LED screens are not actually that great at doing. When your scenes are very dark, there's a lot of black in frame.
It's rough. You're right.
It's not as good, you know. As a green screen can actually work a lot better. You know, it's certain things. It's, you know, ideally you have both at your disposal. We have our guys who are running the virtual sets in the middle between a green and an LED volume, and you literally move the cameras backwards and forwards, you know. Depending on what shot is serviced by what technique, you know.
And that's
the ultimate goal. And that's where you are. You're there for the duration of the production. You don't
That's your company move.
Oh, yeah, exactly. That's exactly
your,
right.
You're just moving left or right. That's your company move.
Spread the lens around that way.
I mean, honestly, that's heaven for a filmmaker. I mean, anyone who's ever been out in on location and you're like, oh, we only could do one company move today because we're in the middle of a desert, but you could, on this kind of production, you can do that. And a lot of things also in virtual production, I've had friends of mine who've worked on The Mandalorian and, you know, the press about, you know, you just put the camera and you shoot. To a certain extent, that's true, but and I'd love to hear what you think, but there is cleanup work. There is clean up seams, you've got to do. So there is, it's not like you just shoot in the can, you're done. Yes, you get a lot more done than you used to, but there is still a visual effects hand that's going to touch it and clean things up a little bit. Is that true?
Yes, it's very true. And you don't hear that from Mandalorian. The PR of Mandalorian makes it seem like it's a walk in the park. And let's not forget that they have huge budgets, you know, like, I've put this together again from my own bank account, at least up until this point, you know. And, you know, it's very different to having, you know, Disney and ILM behind you. But look, you know, I'm grateful to the Mandalorian team because they've made this – everyone goes, oh, it's a Mandalorian, you know. And they're all – you know, it's created a whole sort of mini industry and it's helped my company enormously. So very grateful to you all there at Mandalorian Land, but this is not the. You don't need to do all that stuff to make it work, as we've just proven on a very low budget movie, and we're continuing to prove. It's ingenuity. A lot of it's ingenuity. But as you say, yes. To be clear, there is a lot of cleanup work, but you have to be clever about how you do it. Some shots work perfectly well, and other shots, as we say, you swing around and you're on the green, and they will work better on green. And the one thing that you have to remember is that it's a double-edged sword having your dailies there done in the can on an LED screen, because if you haven't had the time in pre-production to get your set, your environment fully spec'd out the way you want it, you're stuck with it, you know. In the Mandalorian's case, they're not, because they can just replace it later on, you know. Yeah. In our case, it's prohibitive to do that, so we have to make sure that we have it to a level of finish that we're happy to have baked in to the dailies. Otherwise, we'll shoot it on green, and that's our way of keeping costs down, you know. But, you know, look, if you do it right, if you do the right kinds of shots on LED, you shouldn't have to do any cleanup work afterwards, you know. It should be done. It is possible to bake it all in and get it all done. For example, in this film that we're finishing at the moment, a lot of the stuff out, you know, in all the car stuff with a guy inside the car, outside the window is 100% LED sure. volume. Because there's so many shots to finish all those, to composite all those shots in green would have been really a expensive prospect. So we've only stripped out the shots at an absolutely essential that we do on green screen. There's quite a few of those, but it makes it a much more manageable thing. It's on The Mandalorian, they wouldn't care. The Mandalorian, they do it and they go, oh, it didn't work out, and we'll do it, you know, we'll do it the other way, you know, because they can afford to. So
yeah, they'll rotoscope out the shot and clean up and do whatever they want. No, it's pretty amazing technology, and I'm always fascinated by all that. And you know, the thing that's also really interesting is a lot of people think that you have to do, if your virtual production has to be this big sci-fi world building thing, but no, the story you're talking about, the film that you're talking about is not. It might be genre and stuff, but it's not a sci-fi world creating dark city style project, which, you know, something like rear projection. This is basically just really nice rear projection with being able to move the camera and the camera following the parallax on it. Yeah. But I could only imagine what Stanley Kubrick would do with this technology.
Yeah. Well, he did it. I mean, he did it with, that's the funny thing about The Mandalorian claiming to have invented I don't know whether they ever did, but other people claim that they claim.
It's for projection.
That virtual production. Yeah.
It's
been around since day one, you know. And look, the thing about virtual production is that what really is the key is not so much the screen or whether it's LED or green, is the marrying a computer-generated model to the live camera. And as you move your camera, the model will move accordingly. Mm-hmm. That is what virtual production is. And in fact, I know exactly who invented that, and I can't say that it was me, but it was almost me, because the first two films that were done using a very early version of virtual production was Spielberg's AI and my iRobot.
Right.
They were the first films to actually use the technology. You know, at the time that we did iRobot, I didn't know that this stuff actually had already been done. But I was like, I had a scene with Will Smith running around 1,000 robots, mm-hmm. and I didn't have anything real. I only had Will Smith and one robot, which was used as a stand-in. So I go, how do we do this scene? How can I move my camera around and know what I'm seeing through these rows of robots? You know, do we put 1,000 bits of cardboard maquettes or something? And they came up with this thing called, it was called EncoderCam, which was the early rudimentary virtual production thing where we had the model on the stage, my camera on a techno crane could move around, and I'd see this sort of, you know, very rudimentary 3D model move as my camera moved. And I was like, wow, this is awesome. This is incredible, you know?
Yeah.
So that really was the origins of virtual production. And then now that's been combined with, as you say, rear screen a new form of rear screen projection.
Right, because iRobot was around, the LEDs, not so much. Not that affordable.
No. maybe about this big, you know.
This big was about $10,000.
Yeah.
it was all plasma back then. Hey, listen, I still have a plasma TV from like 15 years ago, and it still looks fantastic, and it's still... Yeah. Still rocking at 720p.
Excellent.
Now, one other thing I wanted to talk to you about is a little birdie told me that you might be working on a series for Dark City. Is that true?
I have no idea where you heard that information. look, I mentioned it to one person and on a podcast a bit like this, and I mean, it was great to see so many people picked it up as a story. So much of the sort of genre based, industry picked it up as something of note, which is great. It just showed me that there's a lot of, and you know, I kind of knew there's a lot of, you know, interest still strong there in the wings for a Dark City continuation of the Dark City story. But of course, you know, I mentioned it way earlier than I should have. I should have said, and I'm trying to sell a Dark City series rather than, and I'm making a Dark City series.
As opposed to like, so when is it streaming? And when it's coming out, November? Is it November?
People assume it's like it's happening already. And it's
shot it. It's been in the can. You're just in post.
I've had so many actors applying to screen test and writers applying to write episodes, etc. So this is kind of me saying, don't, you know, let's all take a deep breath.
Calm down, guys.
And wait a moment before I say anything too much more about it. Look, the only thing, because I like you, Alex, so much, as you know, the only thing I can say about it, knowing that's the caveat, that we're working it out at the moment. We're not, mm-hmm. we're not green lit. We're far from it. You know, we haven't, mm-hmm. I haven't even written any of it yet. We're still working on our pitch, on our concept, you know. But what I will say is, it is very much a continuation of the original movie.
That's awesome.
It's not a reboot as a more of a sequel to the original movie. So that's something that maybe will, you know, is one bit of information that people would want to know about. And, you know, I'm trying to, I mean, it is, it's, you know, it, obviously in doing a TV series, we have to appeal to a bunch of an audience that maybe don't even know about Dark City. They've got no idea of this film, Dark City. And there's plenty of those people around. But at the same time, every year that goes past, more and more people become Dark City fans. This has been going on since the original release. So many people have come to every year going, wow, we never knew this movie existed. This is great, and become new fans, you know. So I'm also trying to create a story that that makes those people happy, you know, and be is faithful to the original fans of the series and works into what they would want to see, you know. So I think we're there. I think we've come up with a concept that will work for both sides of the spectrum, and also, as I say, bring in a new audience as well, you know.
Well, that's exciting news, and I want you to have that canvas to play with and to go revisit that world, because it's such a wonderful and rich world, and God, I would love to see it. So I wish you nothing but the best. But everyone listening, calm the hell down. He's not in post, everybody. He's not in post in it already. It's not coming out for Christmas. Everyone needs to calm the hell down.
Sadly, that's the case. And look, you know, this also feeds into the technology that we've just been talking about, because, right, you know, Dark City was made at the time, and I barely could afford it even then. They didn't give me a huge budget, but they gave me enough where I built the entire thing. We had these massive sets built in this kind of aircraft hangar size space in Sydney. We built the entire street that we kept reconfiguring, much like the film was, to service all our different scenes, you know. And, you know, obviously the time has gone, you know, when you could do that on a film like that. But now, of course, this new technology is enabling me to make that world in an even better way, I believe. I don't have quite the fun on the set of hanging out on those in those cool spaces, but beyond that, you know, the virtual production gives you a world that looks every bit as great. And again, I'm not having to limit my imagination, because even on something like this series, which will hopefully be financed by, you know, a legitimate studio with the money to throw at it that it necessitates, there's going to be a limit there. I'm going to, you know, they're not going to let me go crazy. But in the virtual world, I can mm-hmm. do whatever I want. I can visualize it however I want to, and so I think it's the right time for continuing the visual aspect of Dark City in a new form, you know.
I have to ask you, just out of curiosity, when you're going to pitch a show like this, I obviously there's going to be a lot of concept art, but would you create like a sizzle reel, like using your technology, going, look, this is what we can do? Because I know Robert Rodriguez did that with Sin City, and you know, like when there's new like technology, like, look guys, I know it normally would cost $100 million, but we could do it for $5 million, and this is what we could do, and this is how we do it, and look what it looks like. Are you planning on doing something like a little sizzle reel or something?
No, because the movie is the sizzle reel, you know?
Right.
So there's no real reason. So if there are any executives who have my fate in their hands, go and watch the movie, you know.
Right, right.
You know, look, fortunately I'm involved with some people who are big fans of the original movie. So that's really key. But you know, yes, if it wasn't for that movie existing, absolutely, you know, that would be the first thing to do. I've got a film called Sister Darkness that we are that we're trying to finance at the moment. That is we're doing just that with, you know, we've actually created a little trailer and all that sort of stuff, and it's all virtual production, just to show people the way it's going to look, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. It's nice having a studio at my fingertips for such things.
Yeah.
Very helpful.
Yeah. I was in post for most of my career, and I loved having the ability to just like, oh yeah, I've got my VFX team, I've got my post team, I can just, you know, do whatever I want. I never even on the budget. That's so funny. Whenever I do a project, but the budget line for post, I just never even included it because I'm like, hey, I'm going to do the post. I'm going to edit it. I'm going to color
it. It's free, of course.
It's free. I'm going to color. Yeah. I'm going to color grade it. I'm going to master it. I'm going to output it for deliverables. All that stuff. So I never even think about even schedule. Like, how much does that cost? Jesus Christ! I've got a lot of value. I should charge more for this. Now, where can people submit to Vidiverse and submit their films?
It's vidiverse.com.
That's V-I-D-I. V-I-D-I-verse.
V-I-D-I-diverse. Yeah, Vidiverse. I expect you're going to run it underneath me.
Oh, right? I'll put it in the show notes. We'll put it in the show notes. As you do this, yeah. I will have I will have my team. If the team is listening, do it one more time. So Vidiverse.
Vidiverse.com.
I'll make sure they do that.
So it's all self-explanatory. I hope if you go to that website, it explains exactly what is required of you. And please send us your films and we can do something great together, you know.
Alex, I appreciate you being on the show again, coming back. I appreciate everything you're doing with Vidiverse. I love that you continue to take big swings at the plate for everybody. And you also have a fantastic first name as well. So thank you, my friend, for doing all that you do. And thanks again for coming on the show, my friend.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure again. And hopefully we'll do at least one more time.
When the Dark City series releases, and then we talk about it then.
Yeah, absolutely.
thank you, my friend.
Cheers, mate.
I not only want to thank Alex for coming back on the show, but also for taking the time to build Vidiverse and what he's trying to do with it. I really greatly appreciate it. If you guys want to check out anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/511. And if you want to submit your short film to Vidiverse, just go to vidiverse.com. And guys, if you have not checked out the new indiefilmhustle.com, do yourself a favor and check it out. Let me know what you think. Message me, email me. I love to hear your thoughts. If something's not working, please let me know. I've been working hard on it. As many of you know, I do all of the web design myself. All the programming, all the other stuff behind the scenes, I do. So if there's anything that I missed, please give me a shout out. I truly appreciate it. Thank you again so much for listening. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.